So this is the second half of the third class of the United States of America. After this, there's a whole series of moments when the first woman does this and the first woman does this. And whether they are real power or symbolic roles, I think they all have the importance of just getting out a new idea of what men and women can be. And here's one of them, Sandra Day O'Connor, who will become in 1981. Now this, it probably seems a long time ago to you. You weren't even born, were you? But it doesn't seem very long ago to me. Sandra Day O'Connor becomes the first woman Supreme Court judge. Now, if I remember correctly, there are 9 Supreme Court judges. They are the most powerful people in America. It's really powerful. Yeah, really well up there. And every time, very often they win 5-4. Sandra Day O'Connor was appointed by Ronald Reagan, who was a conservative Republican. Nevertheless, for the first 20 years or so of her career as a Supreme Court judge, she was what was known as a swing vote. She would sometimes vote left and sometimes vote right. It wasn't very clear to understand it. But later on, as the Supreme Court became more conservative, then she became a little less Republican. You are appointed to the Supreme Court for life. You stay on the Supreme Court until you die, or until you're too ill to work, or until you resign. But the tradition is not really to resign. Sandra Day O'Connor, interestingly enough, did resign. She resigned when she was old and continued doing other things. But it's and of course the reason they are appointed for life is so that the governments cannot change them. They can appoint the new one. The president appoints the new one. The president, if it's a Republican president, they will appoint somebody who's rather Republican. If they're a Democrat, they will appoint somebody rather Democrat. But they have to be a little careful, because if they go too far, then the next president might also go quite far. So there's a little bit of care here. Now, I have a little bit of information about Sandra Day O'Connor, and here it is.
As the first woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor was a trailblazer for equal rights.
Sandra Day O'Connor goes down in the history books, but she also proved herself to be a fine jurist in touch with the heartbeat of the American people.
On March 26, 1930, Sandra Day O'Connor was born in El Paso, Texas, and later wrote about how her rugged childhood influenced her in her memoir, Lazy Bee, Growing Up on a Cattle Ranch in the American Southwest.
Justice O'Connor has always been an example of somebody who worked very hard, spoke the truth as she saw it, and wrote opinions that were clear, simple, and to the point.
In 1950, O'Connor graduated from Stanford with a BA in economics and continued to Stanford Law School. After graduating, O'Connor struggled to find work as an attorney and instead worked for free for the county of San Mateo and eventually became the deputy county attorney.
She was, in her illustrious career, a path-breaking woman, a woman who went through a legal career where there was tremendous discrimination against women in the law, but it was unusual to be a woman partner in a firm, but definitely a woman judge.
O'Connor continued to serve the public as the Assistant Attorney General in Arizona, and later was appointed to the state Senate. In 1975, O'Connor was elected to the Superior Court before being nominated by President Ronald Reagan as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court in 1981.
President Reagan entered the White House determined to put a woman on the Supreme Court. He really thought it was important, and he also understood politically that it would serve him well, because as a politician, he initially did better with men than women, and so there was an element of politics in him deciding to focus on a woman.
Although considered a moderate conservative, O'Connor provided a crucial vote to uphold abortion rights in the case to overturn Roe v. Wade. During the 2000 election of Bush v. Gore, O'Connor again gave a deciding vote when she agreed to uphold Florida's court decision in favor of President George Bush.
O'Connor was never really a legal scholar. She approached every case on the merits, on a case-by-case basis. So sometimes she would weave to the right, sometimes she would weave to the left. And as a result, she became a swing vote, one of the crucial votes that was necessary to achieve a majority opinion.
Due to her husband's failing health, Justice O'Connor retired from court on January 31st, 2006, but continued to remain active as a speaker, author, and educator. In 2009, Sandra Day O'Connor received the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Okay, so Sandra Day O'Connor. There was just one thing I noticed at the end. Did you catch why she retired? Yeah, so you can still see there's still some gender roles around. Can you imagine a senior judge man retiring because his wife is sick? It's a little harder to imagine. It's a little harder to imagine. So even when you're on the Supreme Court, it's not exactly the same. But I think now there are two. Of course, most Supreme Court judges are quite old because they're supposed to be very experienced. Okay, no, I don't want to evaluate you. Go away. There we go. Yes, it works. God. Okay, so important symbolic moments, 1981. Let's keep going. There's more of them. 1983, then the first woman astronaut. We saw her in the thing last time. So this is MS. This is the soft feminist best-selling magazine. And you can see that it is, by 1983, you can see it's quite a middle-class magazine. Because look at the problems that they have. When a woman buys her dream house, finding the right China trip for you. Yeah, if you want to go on holiday to China, what is the best way? And this is not a working class problem. Yeah, it's a problem for people with a bit of money. Yeah, and business, you know, how to go into partnership. So it's got a middle class magazine, but it's also defending the idea that women should have a particular... that should have the same roles as men. Finally, the story there, should you adopt a foreign baby? Yeah, should you adopt a foreign baby? Which is, in the 1980s, this was not so controversial as today. People didn't really think it out in the same way. Okay. So, now I'm doing all the work, so a little time for you to do a little bit of work. Very short quiz, just three. Stories. In what year did the first woman run for vice president? You can guess. You're supposed to guess. Who was the first woman in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And when did the first woman become a four-star general in the U.S. Army? Let's start with the second one. Who was the first woman in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, do you imagine? Would you like to guess? Yeah, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is a very wide... They have a very wide conception of what music is appropriate, yeah. So you don't need to think just rock and roll. Yeah, who do you think could be? Don't I have a guess? So women singing. Well, yeah, I suppose some women must sing. Yeah.
Soul singer.
Are you trying to get clues? Okay, yes. Aretha Franklin, yes, very good, yeah. Vous savez que Aretha Franklin s'est mariée à un moment pendant peu de temps avec Sean Connery. Elle s'est appelée Aretha Connery. Mm-hmm. So, j'arrête, c'est bon. Voilà, c'est, yeah, I'll stick to teaching. Okay. So here we have the answers. Geraldine Ferraro was the first woman to run for vice president on a major party ticket, yeah, as a Democrat or Republican, because sometimes there are very small candidates who get 1% of the votes, but we're not counting that. So Geraldine Ferraro, 1984, ran for the Democratic Party as America's first woman vice president. She didn't win, she lost, okay? But that's what she ran for. And then you have the badge, yeah? America's first woman vice pres. This is Ferraro with Clinton, I think. I think Clinton was the guy, but I'm not absolutely sure. Aretha Franklin was the first woman inducted it should be the singular first woman inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. 1987, so it's really pretty late, because there was a lot of influential women, you know, Susie Quattro, or I'm saying a lot, now can I find many of them, Diana Ross. In the 70s there were some big women singers, but she was the first one inducted in there. And it was Et tout à l'heure on verra le premier général, militaire. The new law passed in 1994, the Violence Against Women Act, there's a typo there, against women, not against women act, tightened federal penalties, funded services for victims of rape and domestic violence. This is in all countries, but in the United States too, there's been two sides to the question of violence against women. First of all, the law, but secondly, yeah, if women have nowhere to go, then it doesn't matter what the law says. And so services for victims have been important. And that this poster is a celebration or a commemoration of the 20th anniversary of this law, the Violence Against Women Act. To go back briefly to the Supreme Court, as the Supreme Court became more conservative, because judges retired and were replaced by George Bush with more conservative people, there's an element of luck in this, you know. Will the judges die when it's a Democratic president or when it's a Republican president? We don't know, you know, so it's an element of luck in this. And here you have a series of things. For example, in 1992, there was a decision by the Supreme Court which said, for example, states may oblige young women to inform their parents. They can only have an abortion if, in some states, if the parents have given their consent. Yeah. So somebody came to Planned Parenthood, came to the Supreme Court and said, look, this is unconstitutional. This is an undue burden. This was the term in the Roe versus Wade thing. Yeah. C'est un fardeau, c'est pas raisonnable. C'est un fardeau qui n'est pas raisonnable. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's reasonable. And in fact, the number of restrictions which are considered reasonable has got bigger over the last 10 years. In 2007, then we're much later now, Nancy Pelosi, then the person we heard this morning, became the first woman speaker of the US House of Representatives. The speaker, c'est un peu le président de séance. Hein? Who do we have in London? We have a speaker in London, as well, the Speaker of the House of Commons, yeah. Nancy Pelosi takes charge. And in 2012, I told you, the first woman to become a four-star general in the US Air Force. And indeed, the restrictions in the Army for combat roles just disappeared a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. Today, in theory, any role in the Army can be filled by a man or a woman. Of course, as you can imagine, the question of wages is not yet solved. Women working full-time still earn only 77% of what men work. And the reason is that women are very often corralled into low-paid jobs. So, for example, 95% of nurses are women. 95% of primary school teachers are women, and these are badly paid jobs. So it's not because women and men doing the same job get a different wage. It's because there are women's jobs and men's jobs. Still very much the case. I'm not going to go into those because they're a little bit detailed, but those are some more of the restrictions on abortion. Now, when Trump came along, naturally enough, there were a number of women's protests against Trump, because he was he is an exceptional person, and that he was recorded saying that assaulting women is fun, which is quite exceptional. Normally they at least keep quiet about it. So he is exceptional even among traditional men. And so you have this whole women against Trump thing. And in the United States, far more than in France, the Me Too movement, I think the word is okay here, has been extremely influential. Of course, it's something which was not possible in the same way before the internet and Twitter, because you need this rapid buzz things to it, and it has a whole load of different aspects about which you probably know something. And here you have a cartoon by a critic of Trump who is considering that perhaps women will be the people who manage to destroy Trump. It's not happened yet. I think one of the difficulties, because a lot of people were very optimistic about getting rid of Trump 2 years ago, but the problem is that until a lot of Republicans are unhappy, nothing's going to happen. Yeah, so unhappy Democrats, that's not going to help a lot. So I don't want to depress you, but you know. And just a couple of stories for today. One of them is. There are a very wide question, because the idea that men should control public space and women should not is hundreds of years old. And so it's not surprising that it takes decades to deal with these kind of questions. And here is one question just come up to, last year in 2018. There are 150 statues in New York City, in the parks, in the squares, and 5 are of women. And so this is now being looked at as, you know, what can you do about this? And the decision has been made to have more statues of women. Again, this is statues very often. If you're not a historian, you see a statue in a park and you just walk past. If you're a historian, you go and see who it is every time. That's what historians do. That's how we spend our lives. But, you know, nevertheless, I think there is an importance of symbolism. If every time you see a statue, it's always a man, I think it has to have some sort of effect on us, you know. So there you go. New York City has launched a new initiative to bring more statues of women to the city and letting the public decide who the first one honours. The She Built New York City campaign was launched last month by Mayor Bill de Blasio's wife, Shirlane McRae, and Alicia Glenn, Deputy Mayor for Housing and Economic Development. And a city website catered specifically to women's public services allows residents to nominate a woman of historical significance for a new statue. Okay, we don't know who it's going to be. I didn't find out who it's going to be. There are a couple of statues in New York. This is Eleanor Roosevelt's. Eleanor Roosevelt was the wife of the president, but in fact she was extremely active. He was, for the last few years of his presidency, he was disabled, and she used to go and do all the speeches for him. But it wasn't really for him. She was actually a politician in her own right. Very interesting woman. And here we have a statue then of Harriet Tubman. Obviously a modern statue. You can see by the style of the statue, it's a modern statue, it's not a classic statue. And I have a little video for you about Harriet Tubman. I hope. Yes.
Born into slavery on Maryland's eastern shore, Harriet Tubman escaped to freedom in 1849. It was just the first of her many dangerous forays, leading runaway slaves from safe house to safe house.
Harriet Tubman was a very spiritual, very religious person, and carried this hymnal with her on her trips to bring people out of the Eastern Shore in Maryland. She would often sing with them, pray with them, and many of the pages have little X's that designate those hymns as her favorites.
Oh, okay.
The shawl, evidently this was a very favorite piece of hers.
It was tiny.
Very tiny. but she was very strong, very determined, very directed, and had a kind of forcefulness and a kind of authority that people felt when they were with her. You know, they followed her orders and did what she said, and if they didn't, she very famously threatened to shoot them because she couldn't risk alerting the enemy to their presence.
Wow, just to charge. Yeah, amazing woman.
I think the common vision that people have of Harriet Tubman is this woman who would go south during that railroad and bring people north. And that's all she was about, and that was her claim to fame.
By secret paths and waterways, Tubman did lead dozens of slaves to freedom. But her experience also made her a valuable military asset.
The skills she gained as a young woman in terms of the ability to, you know, go in the woods and travel in strange places translates into very useful skills in the Union Army.
In 1863, the Union command sent her deep behind enemy lines in South Carolina to lay the groundwork for a daring plantation raid.
She goes inland, into South Carolina, and establishes relationships with local people.
On the night of June 2nd, she planned a covert operation on the Combahee River. As dawn broke, they took three plantations by surprise. Tubman gave a signal, and the enslaved people rushed to freedom. They burned storehouses, destroyed crops, crippling supplies. One Confederate captain doomed. Their success was complete.
Yeah, Harriet Tubman then, born a slave, and what she's most famous for is this, of going, there was a certain point where some of the states had slaves, and some of the states didn't have slaves. And if the slaves could get to the north, they were free. The law had changed, yeah. And so she repeatedly went back in and brought people out, which was extremely dangerous, and she was saying that, you know, she made sure people followed orders and said, you know, otherwise I'll shoot you, you know, because it's a desperate situation. And then later on she was a military operative in the Civil War between the North and the South, about which became mainly about the question of slavery. So I read that. I'm pleased that she has a statue. I think that's reasonable. I would have. In her situation, I think I would have run away. So pretty good there. The very first female monument in Central Park is to arrive in 2020 in Central Park. Then that's the enormous park on Manhattan, which divides Harlem from the center of town. Unfortunately, I didn't note down who it is. I've forgotten who it is. Another quiz question for you. At what date do you imagine that the percentage of women among directors making top films in Hollywood reached over 20%? Over 10%, sorry. Let's do 10% first. Say again? Yeah, that's right. It's a trick question, of course. It's never been over 10%. And here you have the news from this week, I think, 2019, yeah, the 4th of January 2019, the number of Hollywood hits directed by women falls to 20-year low. Yeah, they are. If you take the 250 best-selling films from Hollywood, 8% are directed by women. So that's, yeah, just to say, you know, there are still Bastilles to be taken. And that's just an article about the National Women's Hall of Fame. Okay, and I think that might be the end of that. I think I did have one more thing I wanted. Oh yes, I know what I wanted to do. That's basically what I had to say about this story. But I did find another little.